there's a difference between how an animal tracks and how a human does? As discussed in his book, Entering the Mind of the Tracker, Tamarack Song shares his personal experiences that show how tracking becomes the literal metaphor for conscious living. Part one today. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Tamarack, unlike most people, including Brian Nez, who wrote the foreword to your book, Entering the Mind of the Tracker, you initially learned tracking from the wolves themselves. How did this come to be, and speak on any level that strikes your fancy?
Wow. Let's start intuitively, because that's where I like to function when I have a choice. And you're giving me the choice, so I'm taking it. When I was young, from my earliest memories, I remember walking out in the woods. I grew up in a small farming town in central Wisconsin. We had woods and fields and swamps in the backyard, and that was my playground. And I would wander out there, and I would feel this ethereal presence. You might call it a spiritual presence. And it was wolves. And I never saw a wolf, of course. The wolves were long exterminated, but I felt their presence. There was something there, and that's something that I couldn't put a finger on, because I didn't know anything about wolves at the time. I was 5, 6, 7 years of age. Oh, I read about wolves, you know, Little Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf and all of that. But that was just stories. Those were metaphors for me right away. I knew that that wasn't true. In a pragmatic sense, but I knew the spirit of wolf, and I sensed that in the woods, and they became the symbol of all things wild and free and beautiful for me. And that's where I began with my relationship with wolves.
I'm definitely wanting to go back to the wolves, but I just wanted to ask you this quickly in between here, how you do now live in an area, and by the sound of it, grew up in an area that was populated indigenously by the Ojibwe, and yet you have learned not only from them, but you also mentioned the Gondongara from Australia, and I'm wondering how that piece fit in.
Yeah, when I finished my first book, Journey to the Ancestral Self, I sent it to a woman in Australia who was an elder, an Aboriginal elder, and I didn't know anyone in Australia at the time. Somebody gave me a name and an address, and I sent her the book, and she wrote back to me immediately, and she said, "Wow, where did you get this stuff from? This is what the elders have been teaching me." And this is what we're losing here. This is what we're losing here in Australia. This book is amazing. And we developed a friendship from that. We developed a relationship. And what impressed me about what she said was that this is what I've been receiving from many people of many cultures, and that is essentially that living indigenously and the ways of honor and respect and living in balance with all of the plant and animal relations and giving before you receive and all these precepts, speaking your truth, speaking from your heart, coming from an intuitive place, listening before you act, all of these things that I've been learning from the elders and from my direct experience in nature are shared by Native people everywhere. This is just There's, in essence, a generic indigenous culture that circles our mother planet. And from there, I came to learn that this is what indigenous people have been telling us civilized people for so long. Hey, you know, you have your own indigenous ways, too. They're the same as our indigenous ways. You are not living right. You're forcing us to live in a way that is not right. It's not in balance. There's no honor and respect here as being a core precept. And that just moved me so much that I dropped all the boundaries and labels that I had about me being civilized and other people being native, and all of my desires to be a native person, and realize that that's already within me. It's programmed in my DNA. We are all children of the mother. And that just helped me to accept who I am and to embrace all Indigenous cultures and learn from everybody and anybody who has something to share with me.
People might wonder, why would I even care about a book about tracking? And the fact that there you are up in cold northern wilderness and and this year-long school formed around you where students not only come once, but they come back again is a brilliant testament. And in reading your book, it's just so amazing to see why the tracker is within us, and it's not only for us in the wilderness. Everything is applicable to life. It is really all about heightening our senses, and you write about listening to the stories of the wolves. And one might wonder, how can you listen to a wolf story? So maybe you can tell us about this sense.
Yeah. There are a couple of good points you've hit upon here. The first one is listening to the stories. The way that Native people approach life is through story. Everything is a story. There is no reality because everything comes through my filters. The way the mind works, I've learned this in my neuroscience research, actually, that when we remember an event, all we remember is a couple of details, a couple of facts. And the rest of it we fill in with our prior knowledge, with our beliefs, with our cultural paradigms, with other stories that fill in the gaps. And this is how we translate our lives. This is how we translate what we see. This is how we create our own reality. And the beauty of it is that there's a language that underscores these stories, that underscores all of our stories. And I call it nature speak. And it's the silent language that all animals know. It's the universal language, and it's the one we intuitively know, too. I'm not using it right now. I'm using a very conscious language, a very intellectualized way of communicating, which is just the tip of the iceberg, really. And when we get down to our intuitive selves and just feel and sense, I disappear, and you disappear, the ego disappears, and we become as organs within this greater organism. You know, just like, Robin, just imagine that you are an organ within a bigger body. Let's say you're the heart. Well, you know heart language. You don't know the language of the liver or the lungs or the spleen directly. You don't speak directly, but you have this communication going. Otherwise, the organism could not work. There's this sense of interrelatedness. There's this sense of synergy and coordination that is going on that you are very aware of on deeper levels. Your super consciousness is connected to it, and this is our functioning language. What we communicate on the surface is just the hi, how are you stuff. You know, the glad, sad, mad stuff, and I need this, or do you need that, and how can I help you, that sort of thing. That's just the surface ripples. The real communication is going on underneath, and this is where we go, and this is where a Native person who is tracking an animal, for example, disappears, and the animal he is tracking disappears, and the tracker and the tracked become one, playing out this. There's this diorama. They're playing out this act in a play, you might say, where they are actually organs within an organism. They're no longer thinking, oh, I'm hunting to get food to feed my family, or I'm running away in order that I am not food for this person's family. I want to stay alive so that I can feed my family. All of that disappears, and there's just action and reaction. There's this synergy going on, and they're functioning literally as organs within an organism, playing out a grand scheme of which they are just a tiny part.
Yeah, and I love that piece. I was reading in your book about how you write, I'd never think of turning my back on someone without an explanation, and wolves didn't need to state the obvious. They were responding to a greater voice, the song of the track. And rather than snubbing anyone, they were giving their attention to that bigger picture you're just talking about. That whole idea of don't take anything personally.
Yeah, that's it. There is nothing to take personally because it is not me. It's not you. It's us together forming a greater organism, a greater consciousness. And the more we can be in that place, the more true we are to ourselves and the more true we are to each other. And you know, one thing I tell people right away when they come to the Teaching Drum School to learn, oftentimes they will read my books or go to the webpage and they're inspired and they say, boy, I really want to learn from you. And I slow them down right away and I say, whoa, you're coming with expectations. You're not here to learn from me. I don't have anything to teach you, but I can help. I can facilitate a process by which you get in touch with what you already know, with who you already are. And this is what it's all about. Otherwise, we're just acting as passive receptors. We're going somewhere to have somebody screw something into our heads and pour some knowledge in, and then we leave feeling more enriched. Well, that's not the way life functions, at least natural life. It's not the way natural life functions. There is a greater knowledge that we can open to. It doesn't have to be inside my head. I just need to be aware of it. I need to be attuned to it. I need to be sensitized to it. And then it's all mine, and my knowledge is all of everybody else's, and we're all functioning together in this synergistic organism.
Yes, and to cut that piece out, you just mentioned it's part of natural living, and I don't care what city you live in, you're never escaping that, or you're never outside of that parameter. Whether we know we're there or not, it is guiding and affecting and there for us. And I don't care what perspective you want to come at it from, but we're tracking. And as you mentioned early on in your book about, you know, whether you're looking for a mate or whatever the situation, there's that tracking ability, which ultimately becomes the heightened senses, the perspective of grandeur and our part of being a part of it all.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, that's so important, Robin, because sometimes people see that they look at someone who is connected with nature and they look at it in the sense that, wow, this is way out there for me. I really admire and respect what you do, but you know, I have a job and I have kids to raise and I have a mortgage and student loans to pay off and a career to feed. I can't use these tracking skills, but just as you're saying, we use them all the time. Googling on the internet, we're tracking something down, right?
Absolutely.
Walking to the grocery store, you know, we're looking for something. We're tracking it down. We are always tracking. Nearly everything we do is tracking. Speaking right now, I am tracking down the right words and phrases to use in order to express what I want. It's all tracking. It's all the same basic tracking skill, no matter what we do or where we're at.
It's so fun hearing stories about the wolves themselves. You write, for instance, there's no simple hello or goodbye with the wolves. And we know people like that. Is that a trait of a pack animal, for instance, have you found? Or what have you observed or found about that?
You know, that's funny. It's something I learned very early from the native elders I apprenticed to. I felt uncomfortable with them because I would go walk up to their house or lodge and knock on the door. Well, you don't knock on the door. You just walk in. And you're not greeted with a hello or goodbye. You just sit down and you participate in whatever's going on. You're just it's just expected. And there are no goodbyes. With the Ojibwe people, there's what they say when they leave somebody is Giga Wabamin. And the term Giga Wabamin means we'll see you again when we see you. And it has a circular feel that the circle just goes on. There's no goodbyes. And there are no thank yous either because it's just expected that when I receive something, I'm going to give it or I'm going to give a share of it. It's just this way that giving is receiving. It's the same with coming and going in people's lives. It's just amazing. I watched it with the wolves I lived with, the pack. There was a pack of four animals, five with me. And one of us would leave and go off and do something and come back, and we just drift in and out of the pack. And it was perfectly normal. There was no formality about it in the way that we formally drift into each other's lives. You know, we meet a friend and, oh, hi, how are you? I haven't seen you in so long. And you go through these social hoops that are expected, the hi, how are you thing, and then the leaving, the same thing. It's goodbye, and it's a formal goodbye. You don't just disappear. Well, when I was with Native people early on, it just surprised me that I'd be talking with someone, and I turn around, and poof, he was gone. And I thought, well, what's going on here? Did he have to go to the bathroom, or
did you offend him?
yeah. Boy, did I offend him, or is he being rude by just leaving like this? And I got used to it, and I ended up liking it. I liked it very much, because being with them was just like being out in nature. You know, the animals come and go, the breeze comes and goes. It's just the way of life.
Yeah.
There's this continual flow. There's no stop and go. There's no A plus B equals C, but there's a web. There's an interactive web that is constantly vibrating.
And yet, you say they insist on sincerity, and I'm wondering if you could relate that to how your relationships were affected by this. I mean, you speak, obviously your whole entire focus and lifestyle has brought you into a very poetic life and such caring. You know, at one point in your book, you're talking about a student saying the student was shy on patience. Boy, there are a lot of other phrases that someone could say, I bet, instead of that one.
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Sincerity. How did your relationships shift because of learning that?
Boy, you know, there in the natural realm, I've learned very early on that there is no sincerity. I remember once a story comes back of me coming home to join the wolf pack, and I was frustrated. I was on my second marriage, and it was not going well, and I felt as though I was playing a game to try to maintain the relationship. I was having trouble at my job. My father and I were in conflict over values, over lifestyle values. And I was troubled, and I just wanted to go and be with the wolves because I could just be my happy-go-lucky self, and they would just accept me as I was. And boy, was I called on that. I joined the pack, and we had our usual greeting, if you can call it that, and right away they saw through me. I wanted to put on a happy face. I just wanted to let it all go and be who I was with them, or who I wanted to be, I should say. And they saw right through me, and they related to me as my frustrated, stressed-out self. And they just brought it right home to me, and they caused me to realize that I take myself with me wherever I go. I cannot escape myself, and I have to be my true self with them. And through that experience, I learned that I have to be my true self always, because nothing else works. And even though I might be able to fool people on the surface, I'm just fooling their egos. Deep down, intrinsically, they sense, they pick up that there's something out of balance with me. They pick up the fact that I'm not fully present with them, even though I try to put on that kind of a front. They pick up the fact that I would rather be somewhere else, even though I'm with them. They pick up the fact that I am not being sincere with what I say, because my body language is conflicting with what my words are saying. So I learned about integrity. I learned about sincerity. And that is not because there is insincerity, but because this is who and what I truly am. That is all there is. Everything else is just a sham. It's just a joke. And I decided not to live that sham or play that joke on myself or anyone else anymore.
Describe shadowing. And how does that incorporate?
Shadowing is what we do. It's the way we learn. We learn by shadowing. And to put it in very straightforward terms, it's essentially following somebody else's example. And in order to really learn something, rather than the typical teacher-student relationship where I place someone in front of me and I sit there in the audience and the teacher explains how to do something, I walk in the teacher's footsteps and the teacher becomes the maker of a shadow. And whatever the teacher does, I do, and this is how I learn. I learn by doing, and I learn by doing what is being done. I don't learn something in an abstract way or an abstract form. So by shadowing, I'm moving within the greater movement, you might say. A good example I use an exercise I give to people is to stand by a small tree that's blowing in the wind, or tall grasses blowing in the breeze, they're waving, and move as they move and get the feel, get the sense of that rhythm and the sinuousness of their moving. And when the breeze stalls and the grass stills, you still too. And when it picks up again, you move with them. And you just pick up this syntax and carry this on into your life. And this can be done easily walking down the street. Some of my guardian training students will tell me the stories of how they fall in behind somebody who's walking down a city street, and they step in their footsteps, and in doing that, they start noticing their posture and the fact that, oh, this person has a little bit of a limp, and oh, this person is noticing what's going on in these store windows, and this person is heading in a certain direction and watching for the streetlights and all the sorts of things that we start noticing when we shadow something or somebody. And it carries us out of ourselves, away from our egos, and into the persona of that person or that object or even the tree. And we start feeling what the tree feels and even thinking what the tree or the animal or the person is thinking. And we become one with that person or tree or the grass. And it's such an invigorating experience to, rather than just being an observer, to be a participant. And that's what shadowing is all about. This makes the difference to me between mere existence and living.
What a wonderful way to be able to shift perspective almost immediately and just come out of yourself. It's really funny when you were talking about that. I was just thinking, on my way to come to the station this morning, my daughter gave me a pair of shoes or boots, actually, and I'm wearing them this morning. And she has the left foot inner heel worn down more than the other. And it's really different than the way I walk. It just threw me into many aspects of her. And it was just really interesting.
Yeah, beautiful.
Similar thing, only this was literally being in someone else's shoes, but it definitely woke up different aspects. It was pretty funny.
You know what? I think there's an aspect of shadowing that you can relate very directly because a good surfer, in order to become a good surfer, you have to become the wave.
Yeah.
You need to forget about who you are. You need to forget about your board. You need to forget about what you're doing or why you're there, and just become the wave.
Just reading your book, people will start remembering and knowing this whole aspect of themselves more intimately. Mm. You've obviously studied the kill, hanging out with wolves. Do you ever think that something is gruesome? What adjectives come to mind for you when thinking about or seeing the results of a kill?
Boy, this is a topic that I discuss pretty regularly, actually, with vegetarians. it's funny because I, when I lived in the city, when I was in my early 20s, I was a vegetarian for a few years. And it was primarily because I did not want to support the factory animal industry. I didn't want to consume dairy products. I didn't want to have any part of keeping animals under subjugation, much less killing them just to feed me. And I came to realize that in my studies, I was a natural resources major in college, that it wasn't so simple as that. You know, if I ate broccoli, I wasn't killing, whereas if I ate chicken, I was killing. I was supporting killing. Well, it turns out that in order to grow that broccoli, the farmer has to clear a piece of land or keep it clear. And what happens to the animals on that piece of land? And what happens to the continual battle between the farmer and the animals who want to come and eat that broccoli? And what happens to the animals who are displaced from that field that is growing my broccoli? They are forced out into the habitats of other animals where they are very exposed. They don't have their natural escape routes. They don't have their dens. They are very susceptible to predation, overcrowding, disease. So I came to realize pretty early on in my adult life that there is nothing any more or less gruesome to me killing and eating an animal than to me killing and eating a spear of broccoli. I am still connected with the means and ends of my existence. I am still a part of the web of life. There is no escaping it. And death, it just ceased to have any gruesomeness. My ethics changed tremendously. And I actually came to realize that by not killing, I was responsible for more suffering and death than if I was directly killing the animals I was eating or the plants.
Yes, and to quote from your book, to plants, losing is winning and dying is living. And challenges are welcome to pass along to the next generation to get stronger. And that relates to what you were just talking about. But also talking about, and this also was in your book, about how in the natural world, there is no early or late when we're talking about, oh, the apples came on late this year or not at all or whatever. And I mean, of course, what more can we say that in the natural world there is no early or late? And yet, I just wanted you to talk about that a little bit, especially with everyone's global warming antennae up. I'm wondering if you could share with us your observations about how early and late seasons are actually crucial to plant and animal vitality.
Yes, boy, that's a beautiful topic and a deep topic because it relates to stress and trauma.
We'll conclude with Tamarack Song, author of Entering the Mind of the Tracker, next week. In the meanwhile, for any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is on iTunes under Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.